Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.
The skies over the New York metropolitan area are cloudy today, and rain is in the forecast, which might make you wonder what would happen if we were relying on solar energy. On this week's edition of Please Explain, we're going to talk about what solar energy is, how it works, and what its possible advantages are when compared to other energy sources, also its disadvantages. And joining me now are Dr. Stephen Hammer, the director of the Urban Energy Program at Columbia University, and Dr. Richard Perez, a research professor and senior research associate at the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center at the State University of New York, Albany. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Hammer, to start at the beginning, hasn't solar energy been the basic energy source on Earth from the start?
Absolutely. If you look historically, you're talking about the use of biomass, wood, and that required the sun to grow. And so for thousands of years, that was how we got along. If you look at communities or cities that were established along the rivers, along the waterways, wind power was an important factor in terms of helping them deliver the goods that they needed to survive. And wind is a result of different levels of heating of different parts of the earth. And so, again, solar power was crucial for that as well.
So solar actually is related to wind power, which is one of the competing forms of alternative energy.
And currently one of the more popular forms of renewable energy after hydropower.
When did people start realizing that you could store solar energy?
Well, I think there was recognition back in the 1950s that you could begin to actually employ it for electricity or power generation purposes. And it got one of its big nudges with the Apollo movement and the use of solar panels to power some space stations and things like that.
Dr. Perez, how is it collected?
Well, you have several ways that you can collect solar energy. You can collect it to serve a specific end-use purpose, like to make heat, solar hot water. You can use natural light, which is another form of solar energy. But the universal one is to make electricity, and there are two basic ways of making it. One is using photovoltaic solar cells, so direct conversion of solar into electricity through semiconductors. And the other technology is to concentrate the sunlight with parabolic mirrors and make steam, and with the steam you make electricity using turbines the old-fashioned way.
And there was an article in today's Times about a decision by the Bureau of Land Management to place a moratorium on new solar projects on public lands until they understand the environmental impact of those huge mirrors on some kind of liquid. I'm not exactly sure what the liquid is, Dr. Perez. Are there specific liquids that are used that work better when mirrors, huge mirrors, are focused on them?
Well, you can use steam, which is just water, at very high temperature. You may use some oils, which will go to higher temperature, and you will also use some phase-changing salt material to store energy.
And why, Dr. Hammer, would the Bureau of Land Management say that there might be a negative environmental impact?
Well, the basic format of the concentrating solar programs is a huge number of mirrors spread out over a large piece of land, all focused on a central tower that is where the steam is generated and the turbine operates to create power. So you're talking about a large footprint, and the installation of these devices on the land. You have to get that electricity from its point of generation to the point where it'll be used by the public and homes around in nearby parts of the country or more distant parts of that country. And so you also have concerns being expressed about the construction of those transmission wires.
Are there also concerns that just all of those mirrors are going to take up a lot of land?
Well, they will, but it's not a huge – we're not talking about miles and miles and miles of land. We're talking about acres and acres of land generally given the size of these projects. I don't see that they're worried about wildlife impacts necessarily. I don't see that they're necessarily worried about long-term land degradation impacts.
It is interesting that on the same day that we got that news, the governor of Hawaii signed into law a bill that would require most new homes in that state to have solar water heaters. But Dr. Perez, solar energy is already powering Earth satellites, as we established, emergency telephones along highways, and heating water with rooftop installations. Is it possible to adapt an entire city's energy system to solar?
I think in time it will not only be possible, but it will be necessary. And the resource is large enough, contrary to most people think, to do just that. Take New York City, for instance. Every square foot of real estate in New York City can produce, with today's technology, about 25 kilowatt hours per year of electrical power. So if you add all the square footage of the city together, you would produce about two times what Con Edison is serving the city in terms of electrical power.
And how much of the city's electricity could that supply?
That would supply 200%, twice what Con Ed, because Con Ed is roughly 100% of the city.
But Germany has probably made the biggest commitment to solar energy right now. And as I understand it, the reason that it's so much in use in Germany is simply because of government subsidies, that if the government weren't subsidizing it, we probably wouldn't see very much solar power in Germany.
Yes. Well, you can think of it that way, or you can think of those subsidies as just the government trying to provide a level playing field for solar. Because if you think right down to it, everything else is heavily subsidized.
My guess...
Or we are paying a price which doesn't reflect the real price.
Well, let's follow up on that in just a moment. My guests are Dr. Richard Perez, who's a research professor and senior research associate at the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center at the State University of New York in Albany, and Dr. Stephen Hammer, director of the Urban Energy Program at Columbia University. We're talking about solar energy on Please Explain today. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, Dr. Hammer, why does it have to be subsidized? Why is it at this moment still not price inefficient to use solar power?
Given the level of market penetration that solar power has achieved globally, it's still less than 1% of total global electricity supply. You simply haven't had market maturation occur yet. And so the cost of production, the cost of distribution, the cost of interconnection between the installation on homes and interconnection with the local utility grid, those costs still have quite a ways to come down.
But what about the efficiency of it? Solar cells at present are only about 10 to 15% efficient. That means that at least 85% of the energy hitting them isn't converted into useful energy. Do we need to make them more efficient to make them more cost effective?
Well, and that's part of what we've seen over the last 20 years. You've seen basically efficiency levels going from 5% upwards to now you're seeing solar cell manufacturers talking about 20, 21% efficiency. And so as the technology improves, as our ability to convert electricity from the sun or solar power into actual electricity, that will reduce the cost as well.
Why are we still having problems? Is it simply that aren't we still looking for better ways of doing this? Why is it taking so long with so many people doing the research? Let me ask Dr. Perez to come in on that.
Well, it improves every year. So it's not that we are looking for a breakthrough and it hasn't come yet. If you look at the progression over the last 20 years, it's been a steady decrease in price and a steady improvement in efficiency. So as Dr. Hammer was saying, we are approaching that 25% conversion efficiency for commercial modules, which is, if you think right down to it, it looks like you're losing 75%. But if you compare it, for instance, with biomass, how you make alcohol with biomass, you have to grow a field, and the yield per acre of making alcohol using biomass is less than 1% because you're using all that land to grow the crop, and you convert that, and then by the time you use the energy, you're down to much, much, much less than solar.
But solar right now also takes up a lot of space. The solar power density on Earth is only 1 kilowatt per meter squared. You'd need to cover hundreds of square miles of land that would then be of little agricultural value because it would be in the shade to replace a power plant that only takes up a few acres.
Well, I'd like to put it one other way. Say let's say we have to supply 100% of the electricity for New York State with solar energy, it would take three quarters of 1% of the land of New York State to do that. And if you think that 3% are already covered by buildings and roads and exclusion zones, you would just use that space, which you already use. You don't need to use break new ground or do anything like that.
And other cities are being fairly creative in terms of how they approach this. One of the, you know, hallmark urban energy plans is in London. And as part of their energy strategy, they've been talking about the flyways, the overpasses, and the train trestles, where you have land that is basically laying fallow right now that could be put to another productive use. And so you don't necessarily need to go on to cut down trees and go on to virgin farmland to install solar panels. You can take advantage of empty space that you already have within a city.
In Germany, they have solar panels lining the highways.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I've read that New Jersey is actually further along than many other states in making use of solar energy. Why New Jersey and why not New York, Dr. Hammer?
Well, they've had a fairly progressive or more aggressive subsidy program for installations in that state than we've historically seen in New York State. But there was some very important news over the last 2 weeks here in New York where a new net metering rule has been agreed to by the state legislature. And that will increase the size of the systems that are eligible for a certain type of financial incentive, and it will now match that of New Jersey. So I think we're poised for a very big takeoff here in New York State.
Just coincidentally, about 6 months ago, I was seated next to somebody on an airplane, a German salesman for a solar panel company, who said that his beat was San Diego, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles. And that was the triangle. And he said it makes sense because those are the places where people have made the biggest commitment to converting to solar energy because of the sunlight. Does it really matter whether you're in an area that has a lot of sunlight or whether you're in an area like New York, which often has a lot of cloud cover?
Well, Dr. Perez has some interesting data available on his website where he talks about we have in New York, we have 30% less solar availability than in Phoenix, but we have more than in other parts of the world, including Germany, where you tend to see higher levels of deployment.
In fact, it's the darkest of all of the countries in Europe, if you're talking about cloud cover. And yet they've made the biggest commitment. So how does that work, Dr. Perez?
You mean in Germany?
Well, or in any place where there isn't as much sunlight as we would imagine we would need to make this work.
Well, as I said, in New York, there is more than enough sunlight to make it work in a big way if we wanted to. It's not like the space or the sunlight is limited, but we would have to develop and invent the technologies to go with the fact that it's a resource which is intermittent, so you have to go by the nights and the clouds. But I think Germany is inventing all those things because they tackle the worst possible case, having their country with a lot of clouds and having a peak demand in the middle of winter and having to incorporate solar energy into that grid. In New York, we are a little bit lucky because our peak is in the mid-afternoon in summer on hot, sunny days when there is the likelihood of having lots of solar energy is very, very high.
If we could also add humidity as a source of solar energy,
yeah,
New York would be the best.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Saudi Arabia of humidity for power generation.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, take calls from our listeners. Our number here is 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729. My guests are Dr. Stephen Hammer of Columbia University and Dr. Richard Perez of the State University of New York in Albany. We're talking about solar power. And we're back with our show on Police Explains Look at Solar Energy with Dr. Richard Perez, a research professor and senior research associate at the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center at the State University of New York, Albany, and Dr. Stephen Hammer, director of the Urban Energy Program at Columbia University, taking your calls at 646-778-3729. Now, I get the sense from our conversation that the two of you are strong believers in the future of solar energy. But when do you imagine that we're going to start seeing some real conversion?
Well, it's really a function of political leadership. I mean, the reason that German salesman has a beat of San Diego, L.A., and Las Vegas is because there's been that strong political commitment made by the state of California to promote, you know, a million solar roofs around that state. We're starting to see similar type of leadership coming out of Albany. We're starting to see that kind of leadership coming out of City Hall. We're starting to see that leadership. We've actually been seeing leadership on solar energy coming out of the MTA. You know, some of the largest installations here in New York City are actually located on top of New York City transit facilities.
Now, Dr. Perez, you're in Albany. Are you talking to people in the state government?
I do that quite a bit, yes, and they're interested.
But are we about to see any serious legislation of the sort that Hawaii has just enacted in insisting that that people heat their water through solar energy?
Well, we are likely to see better things coming from Albany and New York, as Dr. Hammer explained before. There was just a major improvement in the last few days with a net metering law that now lets larger system up to 2 megawatts interconnect to the power grid. Before that, it was limited to residential systems of 10 kilowatts. So that this is one step among many others that have been taken over the years and that will continue in that direction. Because if you look far enough in the future, there is not much else than solar that will carry us through.
And solar, if we do work out a more efficient storage system, that's still the cheapest source of energy, and it keeps on coming at us until our whole solar system explodes.
Well,
then we become a dark hole or something like that.
Generally, this issue of storage is key. You know, one of the big knocks on renewable energy sources of different kinds is the intermittency issue, and the fact that the wind only blows every now and then, the sun only shines for a certain number of hours across the day, but we use electricity 24 hours a day in many cases. And so, how do we generate what's known as that base load power? And what role does solar appropriately fill in our total energy supply picture? Is it, as Richard was indicating earlier, because of the almost perfect match between energy demand occurs in a place like New York City and when solar is available, we could actually see deployment of solar power as what's known as a peak shaving tool. That is to say, addressing when the highest electricity needs when it's needed most.
Well, I live in a building that has a lot of rooftop. Would it be in the best interests of the co-op board to put solar panels all over the roof?
Well, you may recall there was an article in the New York Times several months ago. One of the reporters documented the multi-year effort that he engaged in to try and deploy solar panels on his co-op's rooftop. And it was a lot of internal building politics, and then there were the logistical issues of actually moving forward with the project. Ownership of the land and who gets the value of the solar power, how it's allocated among different users within a building, those are all issues that we need to take on. But the thing we can't forget, and this is something that people in the solar industry recognize quite well, is that if you look at a place like New York City, 60% of the buildings in New York City are 1- and 2-family homes. You know, individual homeowners can make these deployment decisions on their own without necessarily asking the permission of their neighbors.
Because they don't have to feed it into a grid.
Exactly. Well, go ahead, Richard.
Well, they would feed it through their own meter. Their house their system would be interactive with a grid, but through their electric meter.
Generally, because of the amount of space that we have available on our rooftops, we can't generate 100%. We can't satisfy 100% of our electricity needs. So we need to use the electric grid as a backup, in effect. And so,
this is like a hybrid car.
Well, you know, yes, it does regenerate or does offset a portion of the fossil fuel consumption. That's a good way to characterize it. But the fact that we can't generate 100% of our power, you know, makes it something that people question whether there is value in moving forward to that. It is expensive right now, so should I pursue this? I think a lot of people are waiting for the cost to come down. Some of these regulatory changes, there's going to be more subsidy money available coming out of the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, NYSERDA, in the next several years as a result of carbon markets that are being established around the Northeast, as a result of additional funding streams coming their way. And so all of those things may add up to a situation where there is more financial incentives made available that'll bring that cost down.
Let's bring in some of our callers. Our number here is 646-778-3729. Amy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been noticing in some of these alternative energy catalogs that more and more of the products, including now solar panels, are being made in China, which is kind of interesting because they're resisting converting to solar energy, and here they're making solar panels. And I'm wondering, are we using solar panels in the U.S. and Europe that are made in coal-powered factories and are causing more pollution on the other side of the world?
That's a really interesting question. Right now, the way the market works is that the suppliers will tend to go where there is the cheapest panel available.
Exactly.
And that's tending to come out of China right now. I'm going to be going to China next week to work with a group on an energy and climate training program targeting Chinese cities. And as some of the background we've been pulling together for that trip, it's very clear that solar is still seen very much as a boutique application in China. And so concerns about how manufacturing operations are actually powering their production facilities is something that different cities in China have different levels of industrialization. But this is something that the mayors are going to have to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
One more thing with respect to the producing photovoltaic with coal. As China is in pace to become the leading manufacturer of the world next year. But remember that even if you make the PV with coal, that PV over its lifetime will generate about 10 times more energy than it has been using to being made in the first place. So think of it that even if you're using coal to make the first one, you'll make 10 other ones from the sun just by the fact that you're putting that PV in the sun afterwards.
Thank you for calling us, Amy. Richard from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question about multi-junction cells. I wanted to know what the technology readiness on those cells were, because I know that current photovoltaics are in the order of like 20% efficiency, which makes your 1 kilowatt per square meter solar insulation look more like 200 watts, which increases the area necessary fivefold. So I just wanted to know if you could expound on the technology readiness level of the current multi-junction cells, because I know that they're cost prohibitive, but I'm hoping that that changes.
Well, they are not necessarily cost prohibitive. In fact, you can find on the market today some things that approximate it. They have crystalline silicon as the base, and then they have a thin film of amorphous silicon as a second junction at the top to increase the efficiency close or even above 20%. And those things are still in the lab, but I would expect them to reach the marketplace within 5 or 10 years, and I would not be surprised if the efficiency approached 30% 10 years from now.
You also see some of the research going in a completely different direction, where they're looking for an alternative to silicon as the substrate material, you know, more basic plastics. And so the efficiency, the generation, you know, per square foot, per square meter is going to be lower, but the cost is dramatically reduced. And by reducing the cost, perhaps you'll increase the total amount of generation that occurs.
Sean from Bradley Beach, New Jersey. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Yeah, hi. I have probably so many questions, but so I have to narrow it down to one. In the large scale generation of solar power, I've noticed that the Spanish use molten salts to store the energy through the nighttime and then again regenerate, reheat, and then, you know, through the day. Is that an applicable system, or is it getting better? Can it be a better system? You know, that's
They do that in the U.S. too, in Nevada and in California at the Luz power plant. But that's not for the photovoltaic technology. That would be for the concentrating solar technology. Since they produce heat and steam, they can also use the molten salt as a storage material, and then use that same heat later on to feed into the system.
Well, that's what we need to do for massive generation, I think. You know?
That's what works well, but those technologies probably would not work well in our climates, because you need direct sunlight for that. You need cloudless skies for it to work all the time. So that's what you have in southern Spain and California, Nevada, but not New York. So we'd have to find some other ways of being smart about storing energy.
Sean, thank you so much for calling us. My guests are Dr. Richard Perez of the State University of New York, Albany, and Dr. Stephen Hammerer of Columbia University. We're talking about solar energy on today's Please Explain. Alice from Wilmington, Vermont. Hello. Alice, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what do you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk about solar energy in Vermont. We live in southern Vermont, and there's very little of it. Mostly, they're trying to push through windmill farms, and at 410 or 420 feet on ridge lines, which is very obstructive and also not terribly efficient. And I just have always thought that solar power would be the best thing, and I just was wondering if it's possible in Vermont, given the number of snow days or weather.
Dr. Perez is based in Albany, so he could probably talk more about the weather patterns in that part
of
the world.
Yes, that's close to us, right.
Yes. Well, Vermont is not much more worse than Albany in terms of sunshine, maybe 5-10% less, and it's certainly much, much better than Germany.
Yes.
So I'm sure it would work very well in Vermont. The reason why you may not see as many systems in Vermont as you may see in New York or even New Jersey is that the incentives are not as high in your state as they are in New York or New Jersey. But if that changes, I'm sure you'll see a lot of system on many roofs there.
So to some degree, this all depends on the commitment of the state you live in.
Well, it's also a function of the cost of the power. I mean, large-scale wind technology is far, far, far cheaper than the best solar technology right now. And so the investment is going towards the cheapest form, you know, the biggest bang for the buck, in other words. And in terms of renewables, that is tending towards large-scale wind farms.
A listener asks, has written in, what proportion of U.S. electric utilities currently have arrangements for buying electricity from homeowners, business owners, et cetera, who install their own solar panels?
Well, the caller or the email is referring to something called net metering. And that is the arrangement whereby the utility is obliged to buy back at a comparable rate that you purchase power from the utility.
Is that happening in New York State?
We have had it. This was the big change that occurred in the last 2 weeks. Historically, we've only had net metering for residential systems, that is PV panels that are installed on homes around the state. Now, with the new change in rules, it'll be allowed that there will be net metering accommodating systems deployed on businesses and much larger businesses, up to 2 megawatts in size. And so that'll make a huge, huge difference in terms of encouraging businesses to actually pursue this. Most of the best deals that are available right now are for those larger installations. There is an entire niche industry that is starting up within the solar sector. And it's, I could hardly call it niche when you have players like GE getting involved in this. But they are coming in and offering soup to nuts, design of the system, installation of the system, ownership and maintenance of the system. And what they've essentially decided to install a small power plant on your rooftop. And they take care of all the logistical details, and they simply charge you a rate for the electricity that they generate, much like any other utility.
Scott from Englewood, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about I'd like to put my money for my IRAs and mutual funds, transfer it to funds that support solar energy and alternative energy. Do you have any information about that?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Did you understand the question?
Are you looking for an investment opportunity? Or are you looking to donate funds? Or
no, investment. He
wants to know if there are any mutual funds that are actually in support of this sort of thing, putting their money into to solar development.
Yes, there are definitely some socially responsible investment funds that have targeted renewables as the heart of their investment strategy. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any right now, but it shouldn't take too long for you to do some computer searches to find that.
A listener says that until government starts subsidizing installing solar panels, it's almost like a hobby for the rich since it's out of everyone else's short-term realistic budget.
Not far off. I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that there's been a few different studies that have come out here in New York City in the last few years looking at the price of electricity generated by solar systems. One that we had done, and then that was followed up by one that came out of the Center for Sustainable Energy at Bronx Community College. They're talking about solar power being in the 35 to 45 cent per kilowatt or per watt range. And so you're talking 2 to 2.5 times the cost of electricity coming out of the Con Ed grid. So does that make it something that's limited to the well-to-do? Most likely. And if you look at the expectations, projections for deployment levels around New York State, there was some research that the State Energy Office commissioned back in 2002. They anticipated that by 2012, there would be possibly the technical potential was 355 megawatts of solar PV deployed around the state. But 10 years after that, the number had increased to over 15,000 megawatts. So the clear expectation is that the price is going to come down within the next 10 to 15 years, and that is going to lead to a huge increase in the amount of deployment.
And actually, that's part of the question of the next caller. Terry from Long Island High, you're on the air. You want to know whether the technology is going to improve enough to make it much more worthwhile for you to wait a couple of years before you install solar panels?
Yeah, actually, you know, from a political standpoint even, I would, you know, I would like to use solar panels. I'm wondering if, I don't know if it's a big investment right now, and would I be foolish to do it now and not wait for the technology to get even better, or is it worth investing in right now?
Some of the strategy that people are thinking about from the policymakers' perspective is how do we jumpstart the market? And so by improving the net metering rules, by expanding the amount of tax breaks that homeowners are eligible for, and there was movement in that direction as well. And those are all issues that any solar installation company would be very articulate and could explain everything to you about. But they're trying to offer a better financial incentive now to induce you to buy now. Mm-hmm. Over time, that incentive may decline. And again, as the market matures, the policymakers will feel like we don't need to put as much money into subsidies because homeowners will benefit from the decreased cost of the technology itself. So it's this trade-off, and it's a bet. I don't think anybody has a clear sense. Most of the solar installers would argue that with these changes, you're going to get a reasonable payback period probably in the 6 to 8 year time frame.
There's also something I saw a TV report on, and listeners asking about installers who have found a way to make residential application affordable for the homeowner and profitable for them. They install panels for a minimum fee and then for the consumer's electricity somehow so that the installer receives the net profits from the generated solar energy.
There is something called a power purchase agreement, and I was talking about the very large installations that have been pursued in New Jersey, and we'll likely see more of that in New York State in the future. It's the same type of strategy where this third party takes on all responsibility for designing, installing, and operating the system. And they turn into a little miniature utility, and you simply buy electricity from them for a fixed price.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us, and thanks to all of you who have called in on today's Please Explain, looking at solar energy. My guests have been Dr. Stephen Hammer, who's director of the Urban Energy Program at Columbia University, and Dr. Richard Perez, who's a research professor and senior research associate at the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center at the State University of New York in Albany.
Thank you.